This is Sam Edwards, proud sponsor of Heritage Radio Network, SurreyFarms.com.
Sunday, 3rd of June, 2012. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, and we are burning down the house. Your weekly fix of everything related to the built environment. I'm here on this beautiful Brooklyn Sunday with Victoria Myers. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm splendid. Thank you very much. Now, Victoria is an architect in the firm of Hanrahan Myers here in New York. And when I first spoke with Victoria, one thing that she mentioned in our lengthy initial conversation was poetics. And poetics in architecture, it's all you needed to say to get my attention. But today, because I understand that Victoria has a deep and abiding relationship with the world of music, very, very dear to my heart, having grown up in a musical family, I want to talk about how, I want to learn, and you listeners will learn along with me, how Victoria has collaborated with composers and musicians in creating her architecture. Initially, is there anything you want to say about that?
Initially, okay, well, I started out by collaborating with Stephen Vitiello, who is a sound artist, and Stephen had to get a teaching job, so he moved. So as he was preparing to move to someplace like South Carolina, I said, "Stephen, what am I going to do?" And he said, "I have the person for you. You're going to work now with this other person, Michael Schumacher."
But what sort of collaboration did you do apropos of architecture with Stephen Vitiello?
I don't think we ever really got around to doing that much. I did a sampling piece. I put together a sampling show for the Museum of Art in San Francisco.
You mean in terms of installation art, perhaps?
No, in terms of architecture as samples. And architecture samples, okay. And sound artist samples.
So in your work, do you sample sound and turn that into formalistic response?
No. No, it's what it's really about is thinking about the way that you look at your work. Because if you're a artist, and I think if you're operating well within your art form, you probably know the full history of that art form really well. So you're always sampling. You may not totally like put your finger on it, but it's like at the end of the day, you'll look at your work that you've done, and you'll be like, wow, I know where that came from.
Yes, ideally, you should. Yes, absolutely. Okay, go on.
So for me, sampling in music, sampling in architecture, I like seeing the relationships between different media. I like to see how someone who's in a different art form, making sound art, making music, mm-hmm. does very similar kind of work to what I do as an architect.
Oh, sure. I understand that. Perhaps in the context of, we know that Brunelleschi became an architect because he lost the competition to Ghiberti for the doors of the baptistry in Florence. And he was so annoyed, he decided he wasn't going to be a sculptor anymore, he was going to be an architect. Or in the context of Michael Graves, he was a painter first and then became an architect. What?
Nothing. Well, I mean, I guess I sort of feel that sort of bond between myself and people in the fine arts. A lot of my art, my friends are in the arts. And, you know, with Michael Schumacher, I was able to make an even more direct connection. The first thing I did with Michael was a piece at the Kitchen downtown called Architects Design Music. And it was a shocker for me because I didn't have that much time to put it together because Michael forgot to call me to say that the thing was happening because he had said it was going to happen about 9 months before. And then I got a phone call that I was supposed to be there the next day with a score and put together this thing called the light score, which was just a very simple geometric thing. And it was all broadcast through light. And I was completely floored because these great musicians were there. And it was fabulous. And now I'm doing a building down at Battery Park City, where I had Michael compose a piece called Water. And I took his score, which is quite abstract, transposed it onto the facade. The facade is about 600 feet long and glass, so it's got a frit pattern on it. And it's Michael's score, and we're working on having an app produced so that people can wave cell phones at the facade and they can hear Michael's piece. So I find that exciting. I find that cross-pollination between the arts is fabulous, but I also like to have cross-pollination between architecture and sciences.
Yes, and we can get to that later. Early on, in the middle of the 20th century, I feel that there was a lot of cross-pollination between progressive musicians and progressive architects. And if you listen to the music of, say, John Cage or Harry Partch and look at the architecture of John Johansson, you will see that they're all trying to work out the same ideas but in different formats. Joe, can we have our first little break, a little bit of Harry Partch music, please? That's Harry Partch, Catherine Pollock's 1952. That says everything to me about John Johansson's work. And those of you who are younger, my younger colleagues, look at his work. You can learn a lot. There's just an enormous amount of information that you can get from various videos that have been posted to YouTube. So we're talking about collaboration between musicians and architects, and we're talking with Victoria Myers partner in Hanrahan Myers here in New York City. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. This is Burning Down the House. Go ahead, Victoria.
I mean, I love that Harry Parch piece. And
yeah.
for me, I love not just hearing the sound, but I love the beauty, the formal beauty of the instruments that he created.
Yes.
Because he made his own instruments, and every one of them was a beautiful object and a beautiful architectural object.
Yes. Harry Parch invented his own 48-tone instruments. He's a bit obscure. I myself didn't know about Harry until only a few months ago when a former classmate of mine, George Naha, who's now a jazz guitarist, he dropped out of architecture school because he realized that he was already so much better as a jazz guitarist than he would ever be as an architect. And he continued, and now he is a professional guitarist. He introduced Harry's music to me, and it's all of a piece with John Cage and Merz Cunningham and that whole alternative world of inventive acoustic construction, which continues on to this current day with people like Laurie Anderson.
Well, it's
who's very architectural, I think.
It's of a piece, but I also think that when I hear his music, just knowing the beauty of the instruments that he created and also knowing his life, which was so crazy, because he was basically a hobo.
Really?
He was a hobo. And the freedom of that life and the freedom of someone like John Cage, to me, to be a good artist, to be really good at what you do, you need to have that freedom. And I've always strived, no matter how difficult or stressful things become in my practice, to hold that freedom. And I always, when I teach, say to the students, we really have to start by playing. And when I say play, I'm not kidding around. Because this is going to be the kind of play you have to do if you want to be an architect. Because you have to play to make great work. Even if you know your mortgage is overdue, you don't have 2 cents in the bank, you can't pay your bills, you're in really big, deep shit trouble, but you still have to play, because if you don't play, what you do will not be any good.
Well, if you don't play, then you'll die.
If you don't play, you're not an artist. You gotta play, and it's serious play. And Harry Parch, John Cage, they really played. You know, John Cage was so fabulous. I used to run into John Cage and Merz Cunningham all the time on 19th Street when I lived there.
Yeah.
And every time I would run into them, I shouldn't say this.
Did they have a studio on 19th Street?
They lived there.
Oh, did they?
They lived there. And
that makes perfect sense because, I don't know, about 4 years ago after Merz died, I was working at 19th Street and I was walking to the one train and I used to see Merz in that neighborhood.
All the time.
And he'd get out.
Down by the Joyce Theater.
Yes, yes. And so I'm walking on 19th Street, and here comes Laurie Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And here come a bunch of other people who I recognize their faces, but I don't know their name. And here comes Lou Reed. And then I realize that this afternoon, where I'm seeing all these people, they've just had the memorial for Merz. Because he's just passed away. And it made me very happy.
I saw one of the last performances that he gave at Lincoln Center. And Merz Cunningham. And
yeah.
When the performance was over, people just stood up. No one left. Unlike most new things that happened at Lincoln Center.
Yeah.
Because everyone's peeling out.
Yeah.
No one left. And everyone was on their feet and would not stop clapping. Because we all knew. It was like he's an icon. He's a native New Yorker. He's one of our own. And he's a great artist. And, you know, so much of that legacy of what we have from the 20th century was in that man.
Did you grow up in New York?
No.
No.
I did not. I came here from Pennsylvania. I grew up in the Poconos. I was born in Texas. My mother's whole family's in Texas. I was born in Abilene. But I grew up in the Pocono Mountains, and G.E. Smith, the great guitarist, was in high school at the same time I was, and he was across the river in Stroudsburg High School. I went to East Stroudsburg High School.
Stroudsburg.
Yes. Uh-huh. Okay. Yes. And GE was great. And I just remember.
No, wait, wait, no. So, Stroudsburg's like on the Delaware.
It's on the Delaware River.
Yeah. Is that that's the Poconos?
Yes. It's the Delaware Water Gap.
It's like
right
the
there.
Edge of the Poconos. Okay.
All Appalachian right. Trail's right there.
Okay. Yeah, G.E. Smith. He likes plays for Letterman or something like that, right?
He used to be the person who did the lead-in for Saturday Night Live, and now he's kind
yes.
of on his own. But he's been the main guitar person for Bob Dylan. He's been, you know, he's a really, really great guitarist. But, you know, I feel that the great thing about being in New York City is that you have this legacy of these other artists. The first studio I ever had in New York was Keith Haring's old studio. And that was my introduction to New York. And for me, just to go to that studio every day and to feel the presence of great artists like Keith Haring every single day surrounding me was such inspiration. And I feel like in New York, you're always challenged to raise your game. You can't drop it.
Oh, absolutely.
You can't drop it because it's kind of like you're playing basketball with the Los Angeles Lakers every day, or you're playing baseball with the Yankees. It's hard.
Funny that you think of Keith Haring as like a great artist. I used to see Keith around all the time. He was inescapable in the early 80s. Yeah, I mean, he was everywhere.
So talented.
Yes, he was. But he was full of life.
Full of life.
Everywhere that I saw him, he was always just like grinning ear to ear.
And he was from Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Okay. The subtitle to this episode shall be Boosterism for Pennsylvania.
No.
So what I understand you to say is that music was in the air there in Stroudsburg or East or West Stroudsburg, and somehow that infected your desire to make architecture in collaboration with musicians, or is that not correct?
I wouldn't say that exactly. I would say that I was a person who always lived in my head, and that I knew that I was always going to be an architect.
That is
and
very bad.
And I always
that
knew...
That is very bad, Virginia. We must live in the real world if we're going to be architects.
And
come on.
And I knew that I had to have a connection with these other artists. And that was what I was measuring myself against. Not against peers, but against other artists.
Other artists. So, I mean, growing up, did you paint? Did you sculpt?
I did.
Did you do music?
I didn't really do music, but my small circle of friends who I spent my time with included people like GE, who did music in a very serious way.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I feel like I had that influence growing up, but I also see, you know, in the work I do, you know, we were talking earlier about the house that I did overlooking the Delaware River for my friends, Joe
yes.
Amrine and Susan Swinson, who run Pierogi
right.
Gallery. Again, it's like in the arts, you know, I have so many friends who are in the arts.
Right. It's a studio. It's a long, almost Mesian kind of box that hangs off of mm-hmm. a slope, and it's on your website, right?
It is.
What's the URL for that?
It's hanranmyers.com.
Hanranrahan
Myers, MEYERS.com.
All right. So y'all can look that up. But I don't see a lot of music happening in that. I see a lot of containment, almost like making a space within the vastness of the wilderness around it.
You know, every project is so different. You know, that project
is
really...
No, let's stick to that one particular project.
Well, that was really about making a painting studio for Joe and a writing studio for Susan. Because
okay.
they have a house on that same site. And they wanted a breezeway in between. And they came to me and they said, we want you to draw this thing up for us. And we want it to look like a bridge in the landscape. And that's why it's called Bridge Studio.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to take a ramp up to get into it, which Joe asked for.
Uh-huh.
So he could put supplies into a wheelbarrow
and roll
it up to the
yeah.
breezeway,
okay.
take it into the studio. He wanted 12-foot ceilings. with a lot of natural light so that he could do his pieces, which are large.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of specifications for the project, which I think looks great. But, you know, every project has a life of its own. And unlike painters and sculptors who can just imagine things in their own studios, as an architect, you always have to interface with this other person, which is the client, who can either be benign or not benign. In this case, a very benign presence because they're very close friends and wonderful people and very supportive. And it has been a great process. It's a funny process, too, because Joe is building it himself and it's been in construction for 5 years. And not done yet.
Well, that's a long time, but not necessarily, considering that it's a bit remote and it's hard to get to a site that's remote. And I suppose they've changed their minds, but...
No.
No?
He's building it all by hand.
He's building it by hand.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, he's running a gallery. He has his own painting career. He has two galleries in Williamsburg that he runs. He used to have a third gallery he was running in Germany, which he finally closed. The guy's busy.
Now, as architects, you mentioned clients that are benign or...
not benign.
Yeah. In some cases, they're antagonistic, and we wonder why they want to work with us in the first place. Perhaps they perceived that we were masochists and that, got them licking their chops. To a certain degree, I suppose you could draw the parallel to musicians who choose to flip around and be antagonistic to the common taste in music and be antagonistic to the trends in music.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's just music, well, then you're playing to just a few, elect few people who come to your concerts. As architects, we kind of have to have clients.
Yes, we do.
Most of the time.
Yes.
And if you do a work, and I know that in some cases your own work has created antagonistic responses, I can't say that anything that I've ever done really comes close to the kind of experiences that you've had. Let's think about that. I'd like you to frame your thoughts about antagonistic society. Let's hear a little bit of John Cage's. I think if he were still around, he would say acknowledgedly that he wanted to rock the boat. Let's have a couple minutes of John Cage's Sonata 5 for prepared piano, Joe. Okay, that was prepared piano. That was John Cage from around, I don't know, let's see, around 1948.
48.
Yeah. Is Sonata number 5 for prepared piano. You know, John Cage would stuff feathers and bolts into a piano and you get those funny sounds. Sounds almost electronic, which it is not. It's totally analog. You were saying?
I was saying.
Yes.
My second studio in New York City,
yes,
was in an old gun factory, ammunition factory, on West 12th Street near the river. And my studio mate across the hallway was Vera Williams, who was in John Cage's book, Silence.
Who?
Vera Williams. She writes and illustrates children's books.
Dara Williams?
Vera. Vera, V-E-R-A, V-E-R-A.
Okay.
And Vera was there the evening that John Cage almost poisoned himself with mushrooms. That, you know, they were all playing poker. He had collected a bunch of mushrooms. He collected a poisonous one. He almost died. And she knew him well. And again, that to me was a great, great space. There was a painter who had to go through my space to get to his painting studio. His name was Paolo. And Paolo painted Clemente's paintings. He also painted...
You have to forgive my ignorance. I only know architecture. The other arts, except for music, I don't know. Who's Paolo?
Paolo is an unknown guy. He's dead now. But he was painting all of Clemente's work.
Who's Clemente? I'm sorry.
He's a famous painter. And then he did Sandro Chia's paintings as well in Italy. And in fact, he did a whole set of paintings for Sandro Chia. He sort of came back, showed me what he was going to paint, brought all the canvases out. They were like 7 feet tall. She took them over to Italy and had a... They gave him a motorcycle as his payment for making these paintings, which sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And they got a motorcycle for that.
And he was deaf, and he peeled out, fell off the bike, and got run over by a truck because he didn't hear the truck coming.
Oh, that's...
But... You know,
what a life of an artist. Okay.
Again, it's sort of like New York City puts you in direct contact with this stuff.
Yes. And how does thinking about... I know that you spend a lot of time thinking about all these musicians and artists because you've told me that you became friends with this one patron of the arts.
Yes.
May as well talk about
Betty
her.
Freeman.
Yes.
Betty was just one of the great human beings of this country. I mean, Betty, she was a great... She supported all the greatest composers of the past century.
Right, like...
Ligeti.
Like...
Ligeti.
Hockney, Philip Glass. Harry Partch.
John Cage. Joseph Cornell.
Right.
She was amazing.
And how did you get to know her?
I got to know her because I met her. I took a group of students out to Chandler Pavilion in Los Angeles before Disney Hall was there.
Yeah.
And met the CEO of the Philharmonic mm-hmm. at that time. And he introduced me to various people he knew because we were doing a project on next to Chandler Pavilion for the students at Columbia University. And... You know, he was great. He introduced me to these people. The person who really stood out to me, who really shone, was Betty, because she was such a patron. And she had an archive in her house. She had photographed every major composer in the world. She had personal correspondences with them. She had boxes of correspondences. And, by the way, I am writing my book now, Shape of Sound, which is based partly on researches that I did at Betty's house and also sort of talking about shapes of spaces and how they relate to sound, which is a companion piece to the first book I wrote, which is Designing with Light. Because mm-hmm. I'm very interested in natural phenomena and mm-hmm. how they create space and how spaces are created to work with those things.
Well, I can't disagree that manipulation of light is essential to perception of space.
Absolutely.
In my own work.
But not just always, perception of space.
Okay.
But for me, it's about the physicality of the light itself.
But without a surface or a substance, we know from physics, you don't see light unless you're staring at the sun.
Yeah, but...
Everything's either refracted or reflected.
But it's kind of like the Dan Flavin piece. Dan Flavin did that piece in the supermarket where he put every color of light bulb there is around the edges of a rectangular-shaped room
mm-hmm.
so that all those colors would mix together to make white light. And then he put a skylight in the center so you could compare the white light of the outdoors with the light white he was mixing. That, to me, is... phenomenally spatial. And it's a real direct connection between an artist making art, the phenomenon of light, putting us in touch with the knowledge of what light is, which is a white light. It's really the combination of all these colors.
Yes, of course.
And that, to me, is the strongest piece that Dan Flavin ever did.
It reminds me that one of these days, one of the projects that I want to do is to categorize daylight. Because, you know, for example, you know that the light, the typical sort of light in Northern Europe, where let's just make it simple. In Paris, there's a quality of daylight.
Mm-hmm.
And the quality of daylight in Paris is different from the quality of daylight in New York City.
Totally.
Right. And I would like to be able to somehow measure the different wavelengths of light.
Like put it in a bottle and have a show.
I don't know if I want to do a show, but I'd like to understand perhaps how that affects the human experience of life, because I believe that we are very, very attuned to the quality of light. And
absolutely.
And all the different wavelengths, how much of this and that combined together. So in New York, when we have a bright, clear, blue sky day and nothing could be better, what are the components of that light? And how does it compare with a bright, blue sky day in London, both of which I've experienced, and yet they are different?
Very different.
And that's, I'll have to get some of my physics buddies from Cooper to help me with that.
I always talk to clients about this. You know, I don't like to make any selections for any project without taking the actual pieces of stuff to the space.
Oh, absolutely.
With the actual light fixtures that will be in the space.
Oh, you
turned
have to.
On.
Absolutely.
Because otherwise, it's so
wrong. It's not the same
wrong.
Thing. It is totally wrong.
It's not. And, you know, it's very hard to get clients to do that because they don't really get that. The other thing with what you're saying about the coloration of light,
yes,
and how it's so different is to think about Alvar Aalto's Finlandia Hall, mm-hmm, in Helsinki.
Mm-hmm.
That is, have you been there?
No.
Oh, my God. It's kind of like you read about it, you think about it, but then you go and you see it, and it just about rips your heart out of your body. It's so beautiful.
Beautiful. We do have a lot of listeners in Helsinki. One of my correspondents, Lorenzo Servi, who works for Tomas, the wrapping architect, mm-hmm, in Helsinki. Well, Tomas, get me an invitation. I'll bring the show to Helsinki.
Oh, Finlandia Hall, so
get your friends together.
Spiritual,
I'm cheap.
Say.
I'll come for the price of an airplane ticket.
It's absolutely the most beautiful place.
No, I have not been to Finland. I have not been to Scandinavia yet, unfortunately, even though I am half Scandinavian. I just haven't ever made it up there.
It's a funny place because it's so dark in Finland. But when you see that building and it's all sheathed with white marble, it glows like an iceberg sticking out of the ground. And it just, when you walk up to it, it pulls you through it. It's so beautiful. You just can't wait to get from one space to the next.
Mm.
Such a great architect. You know, he doesn't photograph as well as he works. Same with Frank Lloyd Wright. The stuff does not take great photographs, but it's very, very good architecture.
That is so true. Unlike a lot of the stuff that gets published, which,
yes,
looks great in photographs.
Takes good photos, but is not good.
In person.
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't know where my stuff falls. I'm afraid that possibly my stuff is photographed better than it looked. Not intentionally.
Well, we all need the photographs these days, especially.
Yeah, although in 2 weeks I'm going to be interviewing Jim Kunstler, James Howard Kunstler. Do you know of him?
I do.
Yeah, and he's absolutely positive that the life as we know it is coming to an end.
I agree. Well, it already has come to an end.
Well, maybe you should come back and participate in that.
I think it ended about 10 years ago.
Well, he's he thinks that it ended with the peak oil in around 1973.
Yeah. It's so over.
I'm extremely apprehensive about what comes next, although I am encouraged by my younger colleagues who don't want to use the computer anymore to make the drawings.
I'm shocked.
I have seriously suggested in the studio in which I presently work that we have a computer-free Friday where we only do drawings by hand, ideally freehand, mm-hmm. to scale. I don't care if you work with trace over a over grid, that's fine, but hand eye drawing, I don't care if you use a Sharpie or if you use a pencil or if you use a rapidograph, I don't really care. I want hand eye drawing happening. And there was some resonance amongst my mentees for that.
Well, you know, it makes a difference because...
Well, there really wasn't buy-in from the people who own the firm, so I don't know if that's going to happen, but we'll see.
You need to really know how to make beautiful drawings with your own hand to find your own style.
Sure.
Of making things.
And if we could tie that back to music, even electronic instruments have to be physically activated, except, you know, for those experiments in totally computer-generated music, which kind of
What Michael Schumacher does.
Does he? Well, that's...
But I have to say, he's a very soulful person.
Well, I don't care if he's soulful or not.
But we have, as I told you, we have these incredible arguments that go on.
You know, Kunstler says that when there's no more electricity, that's over. That's done. That's fine with me.
Well, you know what I love about Michael?
Only because I can actually draw, and I actually know how to calculate structures, and I still have a slide rule. And, well, okay, I happen to have taught structures for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. So I'm, you know, fresh and up on it. But anybody who graduated from architecture school probably before 1990 can do that also. And I think that's great for us architects. You know, if the grid goes down, people who actually know how to put something together should be in great demand because the need for human enclosure, shall we say, isn't going to go away.
No, but, you know, I have to say that I love collaborating with my friend Michael Schumacher because Michael is 100% electronic without... And he doesn't like to feel that he's allowed anything to guide what he's doing, which is completely antithetical to the way I am. But his knownness to my very formalist way of doing things, it's such a good antipode. And he is such a deeply soulful person on so many levels and so brilliant that I think it's a great collaboration.
Okay.
We have many arguments.
Well, that's fine. One of the people with whom I have a lot of arguments, although I don't know him, but yet I still really love his music, trying to get around back to poetics and a little bit about music, is Philip Glass, who was...
I love Philip Glass.
...great friend of the guy who taught me theater design.
Did you see 1,000 Airplanes on the Roof?
No.
When it was... Oh, my God.
No.
Can I tell you? That was the... best Philip Glass opera.
Well, 1,000 Airplanes on the Roof sounds a lot like George Antheil with his transatlantic symphony for airplane propeller and 12 pianos, but okay.
When I saw that show, I felt like I was watching Mozart do one of his operas.
I'll have to check that out.
But they don't perform it anymore.
Well, I'm sure it was expensive.
It was. I don't think it was. I think it was really low budget at that point.
Huh. And circa what is that?
It was a while ago. It was, I would think maybe 84, 85.
So early on. Okay.
Early on. And it was amazing because he was also doing this thing where he was projecting the sound in shapes around the room. And you could hear it making squares that moved. It was a very architectural experience. And it was a very New York story that went with it.
Yeah. That sounds very cool.
It was amazing.
Well, just last week ago, yesterday, I was in Charleston for the first American full staging. Although, really, it was more like an oratorio than an opera because there wasn't any dialogue between characters of Glass's Kepler. We've come to the point where I have to take a break and go out and abuse my health. Joe, could we have, I don't know, like 4 minutes of Kepler? Track four. Burning Down the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne here with Victoria Myers. We're talking about music and tangentially about architecture. So when you work with a composer like Michael Schumacher, well, I know it's inevitable. We have to talk about what form does it take.
Form?
Your architecture. Yeah, I know. I try to avoid what does it look like on this program, but eventually we have to get around to that.
Well, what it looks like right now on the DWIP building, which is the...
The DRIP building.
DWIP.
DRIP?
D-W-I-P, DWIP.
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 Digital Water Eye Pavilion, which is the community center down at Battery Park.
Okay.
Kind of catacorner across from Ground Zero.
DWIP.
Exactly. It's like Elmer Fudd saying DRIP.
What does it look like?
It looks like... It's just a sort of a random dot pattern, which kind of peters out as it gets to the top.
Now, is that a sampling of the music?
It's a sampling of the music.
That's been turned into a form.
Yes, into a frit pattern.
Yeah, frit. For those of you who are civilians, if we haven't lost you already, frit is a sort of an etched pattern. And sometimes it's made with ceramics that are sputtered through a very high-tech process onto glass. Most of the time, that's how frit happens, mm-hmm. right?
Exactly.
But it could be an etched pattern where there was almost like a silk screen and some sort of acid resist. You know, that would be sort of like a frit, although mostly when we say frit, we mean some sort of sputtered on high-tech ceramic thing, which is more... it's more dimensional than just an etched pattern.
But, you know, this is nice. It sort of, it gives you a little bit of privacy in your space. It also filters out some of the sunlight.
So it's 600 feet long of glass, and mm-hmm. it's got a fritted pattern, and you can point your iPhone at it, and somehow you get...
Michael's music.
Music.
Well, Michael's sound piece. He does not write music. He's very adamant about
And does that.
That
happen because you're picking up some sort of broadcasted thing, or it's like Mobi, like it's like your phone detects a pattern and it gives you a sound?
It picks up a Bluetooth signal.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. All right. Well, that'll be dead when Kunstler's Universe happens, because there won't be any architectural electronics left, because, you know. But maybe at Battery Park City, because all those buildings have their own electricity.
They do. They do. However, it could very well change, because I think Battery Park is thinking of selling itself back to the city now. Because when they developed Battery Park City, they created an option for the city to buy it back for $1.
Oh,
and
great.
I think they're getting ready to...
So the BPHA might go away and it just becomes another part of New York City, and
exactly.
all of the compulsory, you got to have your own power generation aspects of the zoning.
Oh, that's all built in. That's all built in. And we permanently changed the zoning down there.
Oh, yes. Let's talk about that. Hanrahan Myers worked on the master plan.
The North Neighborhood.
Created or finalized the master plan for the north end of Battery Park City.
Yes.
What years were that in?
We started working on it in 96, and uh-huh. it's finally done now, pretty much.
So North Battery Park City starts at about where?
I mean, it's really Stuyvesant High School.
Stuyvesant High School.
Stuyvesant High, yeah.
Yeah. So north of the... Cesar Pelli, World Financial Center.
Exactly.
The Palm Garden, and going north up to about, I don't know, Worth Street or something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Including Teardrop Park and the Irish Famine Hunger Museum.
Exactly.
Are you happy with how that turned out?
I think the Hunger Museum is great. I went through the park finally and did a whole photo cataloging of the pieces that we overviewed, including Teeter Park, Irish Hunger Memorial, and we're going to go through and do a whole photographic survey. And, you know, different things that were achieved, which I think are very interesting, are the heliostat mirrors on top of the
Those
high-rise
scare
building.
Me. They're on the...
They're huge.
Yes, and so there's this park, and it's between two buildings...
And the sunlight's beamed in. I mean, is that cool?
Yeah, or you could get fried. So in between these two rather tall buildings that are around 18, 24 stories, there's a little Vespocket Park, and it's very rugged. It's got It's got rocks and running water and in play features, and it's very dark. And so way up there are these big mirrors, kind of like...
Like if one of them fell, they could easily wipe out two or three people.
Well, yeah. You know, ladies, think of, you know, the traditional makeup mirror, right? And they're way up there, and they tilt, and they are...
And they're big.
And they're very big. They're probably 15 feet across. And they're on these buildings, and they're intended to catch the sunlight and mm-hmm. beam it down into this otherwise very dark park.
Exactly.
And, you know, when I look at that, I feel like I'm going to get fried like an ant under a magnifying lens.
It's still a little bit lugubrious in there, even with the heliostats.
Well, it is a dark space that...
thank goodness for the heliostats.
Yes. Now, whose idea was that, the heliostats?
You know, it happened so long ago.
It just happened.
I think
somebody said, "Oh, mirrors would be a great idea."
You know, when you're doing architecture, especially when you're doing a master plan, you're part of a team.
Yeah.
And
collaborative works just turn into ideas.
You know, it's kind of like there is no I in team.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I wasn't saying that you should take responsibility for that.
No, but
or credit. I would just like to know whose idea was that, because it, on one hand, it's brilliant. On the mm-hmm. other hand, it seems sort of like demonic. It's got a steampunk sinister aspect to it.
I don't know. It's actually helpful. There was a city someplace in Northern Europe. I can't remember where it was, but the city was uninhabitable. Because they were in a valley and they never got sunlight, and they invested in a few heliostats, and the city has actually become habitable again.
Well, you got to keep working the mirrors then.
Yeah.
All right. Interesting. Okay, so we talked a little bit about what your DWIP looks like. What are other projects that are inflected or influenced by music that you might want to talk about?
Well, we finished Infinity Chapel about a year ago, and that's in Washington Square Park. Uh-huh. And it was a project, it was a funny project. To me, it's a beautiful space because it's a perfect cube, has some deformations in it that they create curvatures. We thought of,
Do the curves bulge in or do they bulge out?
They bulge in.
Oh, that's good.
And that was all requested actually by the client who hired us saying that they wanted curves,
okay.
Which is highly unusual.
Yeah.
It was for the 10th Church of Christ Scientist group who had a church on McDougal Street, just one block north of Washington Square Park. And they had redone the building in the 60s where they covered the entire facade with bricks. So it's a six-story building with no windows. And my first reaction was, hey, let's just take the brick off and, you know, reopen all the windows and just make the bottom where the church is going to be. Well, first it was, you know, right at the street side of the building is the Christian Science Reading Room. Mm-hmm. And then the chapel is a double-story space behind that. And so the concept was to just flatten out the floor. We tilted it a little bit, and we put in five holes in the floor, which are like these oculuses, which mm-hmm. bring the light of the upper level into the basement, which is going to be the Sunday school. Mm-hmm. So that as you walk from the street side of McDougal to the back of the chapel, you're guided by these skylighty things, which have lights in them that light up and also down mm-hmm. into the space below. But then the very back of the chapel, we put a garden, which they never had before either, because they were completely enclosed before. Mm-hmm. They blocked out all the windows and the back and the front. And I just said, hey, you know, open the whole thing up, put a garden back there.
But this doesn't really speak to music.
Well,
it was a
funny space in that I didn't think of it so much as a sound space, but we worked with Jaffe Holden, who are phenomenally good sound people.
Yeah.
Mark Holden is a very dear friend and a brilliant acoustician. And everyone who works with him, I have to say, is amazing.
You didn't have any training yourself in acoustics?
Well, you know, some. But these guys are amazing. I mean, these guys know more about the mechanical aspects of the design than the mechanical engineers do.
Yeah, of course.
They're absolutely brilliant. And every single one of them has a PhD.
When it comes to eliminating unwanted sound from mechanical systems, for sure.
But they know the name of every piece of equipment. They know exactly how to tweak it and how to fix it.
Yeah, okay.
They're amazing. And it was such a tough project. It took over my life for 5 years. It was such a tough project. I didn't even think about the sound. And then the Architectural League of New York scheduled an event where they wanted to do a walkthrough with people. And, you know, I was in the chapel and I started to make the presentation about what we had done. And Anne Reiselbach at the League said, "Get away from the mic." I was like, "What?" She said, "Move away from the mic." I was like, "Why?" She said, "The acoustics in this room are so spot on perfect that we want to endure hearing your voice without a mic." And I was like, "Really?" I said,
"Are you friends with Anne?"
Yes.
I tried to friend her on Facebook, but she won't friend me back.
She's a great person.
I'm sure she is.
She's a great person. And I have to say, the thing that I love about Anne and about the League is that they have always stepped up to the plate and have supported people who are doing work.
Oh, yeah.
Which is...
Oh, they're a great supporter of people who are trying to do real architecture.
Exactly.
Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, I'm so supportive of that.
Yeah.
Because it's not commercially viable.
Hasn't been, has it?
No, it's not.
Most of the stuff that gets built to the lowest common denominator.
Yes.
I think we've almost come to the end of our... Hold on, Joe. Of our appointed time. Because you don't know this song, we're going to go out on the Kinks, Victoria. this is Curtis B. Wayne. We've been talking about things architectural with Victoria Myers, architect of New York. This is Burning Down the House. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith. Now you can play... Track 6, please, Joe.
When I go, I shall fight for this land. I shall die. Let the sun never set.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.